So is your being more cuddly than you are jealousy or mm-hmm. whatever more a function of your body's generation of oxytocin
oxytocin
oxytocin versus acetaminophen? No.
Hey, I'm Nicole.
And I'm Mark.
And this is Never Mind the Music. What are we talking about today, Mark?
We are talking about Mariah Carey, Emotions.
Love it.
It almost feels silly, like, going through the history and, like, talking through. She just has so many hits.
She's awesome.
So, so crazy. And in terms of the history and all the magic behind Mariah Carey, we're actually going to, I'm going to just tease.
Okay.
Tune in, everybody, next week. We have a conversation with someone who's worked closely with her, and there's just so many fascinating things to talk about.
Sure.
Really looking forward to that. I think there's also a lot of drama that says maybe more about our society and the music industry than anything else. And some of that stuff's been covered in other venues, but maybe
sure,
we'll touch
like
on some of it.
More drama about like Mariah Carey.
Mariah Carey and the music industry's sort of treatment of her and toxic relationships with other people
well,
in the music
tough.
Industry.
It's tough to be, I think, a woman in this industry, from what I understand, that you're always kind of pitted against other women and like there's just not enough space for multiple women to exist in the same like category of musicians. And I think that Mariah Carey does take up a lot of space because she's super duper talented. Her hair's really, really pretty. And she's a boss. Like, that's just it. And people get scared of strong, powerful women. And Mariah Carey knows what she wants. And she just goes for it. But maybe that wasn't always the case. So I'm interested in learning more about her as a human.
Yeah, tune in next week, everybody. Mm-hmm. But let's just, how big is Mariah Carey? Can we just like talk data
for
a minute here?
Okay,
so stats. Mariah Carey is the 11th best-selling artist of all time.
She didn't make the top 10. That's unbelievable.
Super close. 236 million records sold. Can you guess five people in the top 10? Could you choose, can you accurately predict who five of the people who have bested her in terms of music sold?
Is this female musicians or any art bands or solo artists or just anyone?
Anyone. If we were just considering female musicians, she's definitely not the 11th.
No.
She would be higher
anyone?
Ranked.
Sure.
Anyone. What do you got? Give me five.
Beatles, Rolling Stones.
Okay. Right, wrong.
Metallica.
No.
Pearl Jam.
No, Pearl Jam.
I don't know.
Pearl Jam's
I'm
great.
I'm stressed out.
You're a child of the 90s. Pearl Jam is not more popular than Mariah
definitely
Carey.
The Beatles.
The Beatles. You got one.
Okay. Elvis, probably.
Elvis.
Eric Clapton, maybe.
Definitely not. Most of these are not surprising, but
I just
a few
can't
are surprising.
Think of them. I'm feeling very attacked right now. Feeling very put on the spot.
So you want to know the 10?
Yeah.
Beatles.
Yeah, I got that.
Someone the listeners heard me really stressing out about a few weeks ago.
Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Elvis, you got one.
Yeah.
Elton John.
Oh, sure.
Queen. That one's a little surprising. Mm. Queen feels a little bit like...
Well, they're still making
like
money.
If you told me Pearl Jam, I'd be like, okay, like Pearl Jam's huge. Queen's huge. Madonna.
Prince, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Led Zeppelin.
I've been on a Led Zeppelin kick lately.
Well, you're the reason then.
I think like I'm the one.
Rihanna.
Wow.
Rihanna is huge, but I don't think people realize how huge she is.
Are they talking about net worth? Because she's got like... Like she has a lot. Her Fenty, her like makeup brand is huge.
I think it's
and like she has a lot of
sold.
Like voiceovers. Records sold.
Records sold. Because we're not talking the hip hop entrepreneurs and all that. We're not talking like, you know, Elon Musk's funk band he probably started or whatever with 17 of his kids. Like, I don't know. Like rich people. What's the guy that started the blues band who owns one of the New York Knicks or something? Help me out, New Yorkers. There's one of your guys.
I have no idea.
I don't remember. I can't off the top of my head. One of the scions of one of the sports dynasties started a band and
I don't know.
Sells out crowds because he's a famous rich guy. Mark from the future here almost had it. It is indeed the New York Knicks and it's the owner, James Dolan. His band is JD and the Straight Shot. Go buy a ticket. He needs the money, I'm sure. I shouldn't joke though. Maybe they're awesome, but don't tell the Celtics fans around here.
Who else? Will Smith?
Will Smith. No, not Will Smith. Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
And Eminem.
Wow.
So a couple surprising ones. So Dark Side of the Moon for a while there was the top selling album of all time.
Yeah, so the only two females on that in the only female in the top 10 is Rihanna.
Madonna.
And Madonna.
So that would make Mariah Carey the third.
Third.
And so, and if you take out the band, so like male solo artists, MJ, Elvis, Elton John, and Eminem, and then the bands, Beatles, Queen, Zeppelin, and Pink Floyd.
Wow.
It's a lot of 70s.
You would think that like 60s. The Backstreet Boys or like New Kids on the Block.
Yeah. I just think.
Put them there.
I just think some of those groups are too short lived.
Yeah, probably.
And also the era, right? Like it could be BTS now, except that people aren't buying content in the same way. Like streams don't count quite the same. Like
if we
ranked streams, I'm doubting that Led Zeppelin has as many streams as BTS or
like K-pop Demon Hunters.
That's right. Yeah, that's
are you into that in this house?
There's some of that in this house.
Edit it out.
Why edit it?
It's not evergreen content.
Evergreen content. Yeah.
It's really good though. The music's really good.
More data.
Okay.
She has the second most number one singles of all time. 19.
Second
most. Number one, 19 number ones on the US. This one, I know enough about charts to say this is the Billboard Hot 100.
Uh-huh.
So in the United States, can you guess who else is in the top five? Who's number one?
Top singles.
Number
in
one
the US.
Singles in
Michael
the US.
Jackson.
The Beatles. Michael Jackson is tied for number four with 13. The Beatles are number one with 20.
Uh-huh.
Number two, Mariah Carey with 19.
Wow.
Number three, Rihanna with 14 number one hits.
So Mariah Carey could, if she has one more number one hit, could outrank the Beatles.
Or if she gets a Stranger Things moment with
we
like running up
happen.
That hill and some song of hers comes to number one in 2025 because or TikTok trends or something.
Maybe that's a good question for our guest. What do you think the most underrated Mariah Carey song is? And maybe we can propel it
to
the top.
We can get it to number one.
And then get that bag.
Great. That's right. So number four. but she's got to have two more to win.
Oh gosh, that's
tied
no
with
way.
The Beatles. Being tied with the Beatles is not enough. You have to beat
it's
the Beatles.
It's not enough. Yeah, I would.
Yeah.
You would never.
So number four is Michael Jackson tied with Drake. Of all people.
Gosh, wow.
Shout out to Drake. He was ruined
something
by our podcast
with
coverage.
That spot, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Some bad mojo on
Look,
that
Look, I
spot
do not think
rankings.
Michael Jackson's controversy and Drake's controversies are quite on the same level.
No, if you've read the text, dude.
Yeah, and
gross.
Kendrick maybe has something else to say about that. Okay.
Kendrick, let us know.
Number five is a tie. Also, Madonna, The Supremes, and Taylor Swift, all with 12 number ones. So that's a stacked number five or top five.
I bet Taylor Swift by the end of her career will have she's got probably at least another 15 years.
Sure.
Making
and
music.
She can climb up that rankings and so could Rihanna. So could Drake.
Rihanna's done with music, man. She's just having babies and making lipsticks now.
She could come back to music. Lipsticks. Yeah. I mean,
they're great. It's a really great line. Whatever.
Rihanna.
You're not
sponsor
a Sephora
us.
Girl.
Yeah. No, I'm not a Sephora girl. Okay. One other thing, one other number associated with Mariah Carey that I wanted to mention before we get into the music, although this is kind of related to what I'm talking about today. She apparently has a 5-octave vocal range.
I believe it.
5 octaves, meaning like if C is one note, you go up to the next C, that's C, D, E, F, G, A, B. That's an entire octave. She's got 5 of those, but that is not the world record.
What? It's
Do you know
impossible.
What the world record is?
Probably more than 5.
I actually want to fight the Guinness people, because this world record, I question it. Because it's allegedly 10 octaves.
That's unbelievable.
10 octaves. And it's this guy, Tim Storms.
Okay.
I have heard of him years below.
It sounds like a made-up name.
Years
a
before,
percent.
Rather. It sounds like a made-up name. I don't think it is. This guy has a crazy low voice. And someone years ago had sent me, oh, check out this. It's gospel singer.
Mm-hmm.
And let me play it for you. But I have to question their methodology and the actual idea of 10 octaves.
Like, yeah, you can sing a low C and a super duper duper high C, but can you like make it sound magical?
Is it singing, right? Well, listen, take a listen. Take a listen to our boy, Tim Storms.
Your boy.
Save yourself. I walk. that lonesome road. Lonesome.
He sounds like a creep and a half.
What? What do you mean? Because of his voice?
Yeah.
What kind of new ism did we just create here?
I don't
that's
like
That's
going to
become a...
It makes me like actually uncomfortable. His tone makes me uncomfortable.
Systematic voicism is one of the worst ills of society.
Ugh.
Just because it's so... I mean, his voice is so low. Now, the thing about the 10 octaves, the piano is 7 octaves.
Yeah. Do you have the high end of him?
So I could not find videos of him singing high.
How convenient.
And so the thing is, the thing that I quibble with on this is...
quibble.
With the Guinness people. Look, the Guinness Book of World Records, wasn't it started to settle bar bets over Guinness
Let's
beer? So
that.
Like, I...
Is that true?
That's what
Guinness,
I think is true.
Why?
It's that Guinness.
That
those Guinness?
Guinness
people.
Okay.
It's not Alec Guinness, you know, or
Guinness.
Other famous Guinnesses.
Okay,
it's
go on.
Allegedly, he can sing lower than the piano goes, right?
Okay.
And the lowest note on the piano, that low A0, is already barely perceptible as a pitch. Like if you bang that note, it just sounds like a fart kind of. And so I guess I question what is true pitch generation. Like
right.
I can go,
yeah.
Duh. And
it doesn't sound like singing.
It doesn't sound like singing. Like that's called vocal fry or strobos. And obviously my voice is not low like his, but it's like, can your voice box make the sound? Yes. Does that count as your vocal range? Whereas Mariah Carey has some low notes and some insane high notes that she's actually performing them.
Right.
What he just sang, Lonesome Road, like that is him singing and it's musically useful range. But the Guinness people are giving him like multiple octaves lower than that as counting. And I just think from a laws of physics perspective, maybe you're seeing the waves beat a certain way.
Mm.
But if that's like his vocal cords scraping together, rattling like crickets, I don't know that that really counts. But I'm not the expert on that stuff.
You're no Guinness.
I'm no Obi-Wan. So, all right. So I wanted to take this idea of her crazy vocal range and actually talk about the musical use of it and songwriting and performance trick that's pretty darn effective in this song. And my side is pretty self-contained about the music, but like, do you want to jump in with any psyche Mariah Carey stuff aside from what we're going to say for our conversation next week? Or do you want to just wait to hear out some of the music?
I'll like foreshadow. Like, I think that the song Emotion that we're discussing today, and when you layer that on the concept of like her vast vocal range, I think you could make connections to how nuanced and widespread our human emotions are and how we can go from like 0 to 60 in just a second. And this idea of like some people have a real like high arousal, positive affect to them, like an affect is your kind of general like the vocabulary of your personality in terms of mood and emotion. And some people just have a high affect that are really like easily aroused and like hypersensitive, and some people just don't. And I think that that's a really interesting concept that I'd like to touch back on later. And also when we think about love, and this song brings up a lot of like love feelings and how love can act as like a natural stimulant in several different ways. And the neurochemicals that are involved in that process are really interesting. So I'd like to talk about like vasopressin and oxytocin specifically today, about the different types of love feelings that those neurotransmitters can invoke in us. And maybe even we might need to talk about what a neurotransmitter is. I don't know. I'm looking at your face right now. And
let's start there.
Yeah.
Let's start there. Okay. So this song, spoiler, I'm talking about how the extreme emotions are represented by extreme changes in not just, oh, wow, her range is wide. The thing that makes this song crazy, and some of her music does this as well as other great songs, is she's jumping between it with like an immediacy, and it's clearly intentional, but it's striking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Massive leaps of multiple octaves in one note. So within one melody, right? So you're talking about chemicals, neurotransmitters, firing, causing that stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah. You want to unpack some of that now? And
yeah.
We'll
like
later?
I can just give you a quick primer on like what a neurotransmitter is, if that's probably helpful.
Sure. And I'm sure some of this we've covered already.
Right. So
talk to us about the emotions, the drugs in our system.
Cool. Yeah, we have like, I'm going to use like non-clinical, non-sciencey terms just to explain it in a way that like everyone can understand. We have drugs that naturally occur in our bodies that make us feel certain ways.
Sure.
A lot of the drugs that someone might take recreationally is just playing into the neurotransmitters that already exist in your
body.
So
like dopamine or whatever is
dopamine or serotonin's a big one.
Sure. Yeah.
So serotonin is a neurotransmitter that makes us, simply makes us feel happy.
Yep.
Right? Certain drugs like MDMA might release all of our brain's serotonin or dopamine to give us that feeling of happiness. Some people, when that serotonin is released, it's like a lock looking for a keyhole to go into in your brain. Sorry, when the serotonin goes into that keyhole, it like unlocks the feeling of happiness, right?
Yeah.
So what happens sometimes, well, a lot of times, is the serotonin like shoots across this synaptic cleft, right, to get into the keyhole, and it doesn't
cleft?
Unlock. It's, this is called the synaptic cleft. It's like a gap between synapses. It's like a microscopic.
So, sorry, my mind was blown because of the word clef, right?
Cleft.
Which means key.
Yes, it does.
In music, yes. It must be related. Sorry.
It must be related.
Distracted.
Serotonin shoots across the synaptic cleft into the keyhole, right? And unlocks happiness, right? But it kind of misses sometimes. And
the keyhole being a neuron or whatever.
A synapse or like a
synapse. Okay, yeah, on a neuron.
Sometimes it misses the keyhole and like goes off into the space of your brain, right?
Yeah.
And what happens in people that have depression is it misses the keyhole a lot. So you never get the happiness. It never connects. And the serotonin just kind of goes off into your brain.
So you're getting, your body is still generating the serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not being like effectively transmitted.
Yes. And for for everyone, like it misses the mark a lot of times for a non-depressed human.
Sure.
But we have a process in our brain called reuptake that those missing floating bits of serotonin kind of course correct. And they go back to the beginning of the process and they wait for their second chance. And that's like what an adaptive brain does, is it's not connecting every time. A lot of serotonin gets floated away. And then you have a process called reuptake that brings it back to the beginning so it can try again. Totally average.
Upcycling.
Yeah, it's like upcycling, right? So if you have depression, you might take something called an SSRI, which is like a Lexapro, Wellbutrin, or like any depression med.
Sure.
Right? That's called the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And what that drug does in your brain is catches all that serotonin that floats off into space that isn't naturally going back to the beginning because your brain's broken from depression. It's a loaded way to say it. And that drug helps that serotonin go back to the beginning.
Okay, so in emotions in general, right? This one's about love, but emotions, you're telling me that there is a body drug, serotonin, for example, that is associated with triggering the emotion of happiness and pleasure. Maybe not pleasure, that might be a different one, dopamine or whatever, right?
Dopamine's like pleasure and reward.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there aren't chemicals triggering sadness. It's the absence of the happy chemicals.
Yeah.
So I assume, though, there are chemicals that trigger fear.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not just the positive emotions that are associated. Fear is an emotion, right?
Fear isn't just, for sure, an emotion, but that's more triggered by your peripheral nervous system. Okay. So there's...
Not that this song is about fear.
No, but it's good to contextualize it. So we have neurotransmitters in our brain, but we also have hormones in our body that are manufactured through our endocrine system. So your endocrine system is kind of starts with the pituitary gland, which is in the limbic system of your brain, in like the middle of your brain.
Okay.
A lot of the endocrine reactions, for sake of this conversation, you could say are regulated by your central and peripheral nervous system. You sense the world around you. And that system is sending signals up into your brain to release certain hormones, to release certain neurotransmitters. It's releasing cortisol, which is a hormone that makes you feel stressed out. Like, you know, when you're walking down the street and a dog barks at you and you get kind of like jump for a minute.
Yeah,
you
get
like your heart beats fast, right? That is a cortisol reaction because your body's saying you're in danger right now. You need to look alive and react. Right?
So that's another emotion or state of being or whatever that is triggered by a neurotransmitter.
Or hormone in that
or
case.
Hormone.
But
hormone.
It's
sorry.
They usually work together.
Right.
Right. So love, right? Let's get away from fear. We can talk about that. I would love to dig into that in another episode. So love is usually mapped back to two major neurotransmitters. One is oxytocin and the other is vasopressin. Are you familiar with any of those words? Have you heard them before?
I've heard them. We may have even mentioned them in passing in a previous episode, but
so they say oxytocin is like the cuddle. They call it like the cuddle drug, like new mothers or any primary caregiver, even if it's if there's not like a biological mother, the primary caregiver is going to release a lot more oxytocin. It's that thing you get with like skin to skin contact, the need to, when you feel like get a nice hug from someone, that like warm, fuzzy feeling you get. It's like a love feeling. It generates oxytocin.
Okay.
We see it a lot in a lot of like kinship relationships. And that is definitely one flavor of love. But then you have to think, like, there are plenty of people that when they experience love, it feels more fiery. It feels more like passionate, possessive in a way, right? It doesn't feel like cuddly, but it still feels like love, right?
Yeah.
So that's not oxytocin. That's vasopressin. So vasopressin is that love chemical that's triggered. Like if you see your girlfriend flirting with another boy at a bar and you want to go like throw punches, right?
Like the jealousy drug.
Like the jealousy or like the mama bear feeling. Like I love to cuddle with my kid. If I see another kid picking on her, I want to, sorry, listeners, I'm looking to punch that kid in the face. Like stay away from my kid. That feeling, which I'll have to say.
Nicole's not allowed anywhere near a school.
I've never felt that feeling of rage, that like love-based rage before until I had a kid. Like it's just not how I'm wired. But something about
the mama bear thing.
It's the mama bear thing. And it's real. And I never understood it until I felt it. Like I didn't have that. But then I talked to some of my students and they say, especially now, I think more than ever, they say, yeah, we don't want to cuddle, but I'll throw a punch if you look at my boyfriend the wrong way. But it is really interesting. And you can definitely just use it as a guide to someone's personality. Like you would, if you didn't know me, after 10 minutes just having a conversation, you would know that I'm not someone that's a jealous person. I'm not someone that's going to throw a punch if you're like looking at my husband the wrong way.
Right.
I just don't care. And some people really, really care. And I've always wondered, like, what's the difference? I'm definitely more oxytocin driven. I definitely am a hugger more than a fighter. I just am. But it's all this idea of being rooted in love. And it comes back to many things. It comes back to the way you were raised and the environment you grew up in. But when we boil us all down, we are just, sorry, folks, like meat puppets with a bunch of chemicals bouncing around. And our neurotransmitters really do run the show along with our endocrine system when we talk about ranges of emotion.
So is your being more cuddly than you are jealousy or whatever more a function of your body's generation of oxytocin.
Oxytocin.
Oxytocin versus acetaminophen. No.
You're too close to when you talk about acetylcholine, which is another neurotransmitter.
No, sorry, I already spaced on
what it is. Vasopressin.
Vasopressin. Mm-hmm. Are you generating more than one in the other, or are your neurotransmitters more effectively grabbing one more than the other?
Maybe. I don't really know. They could probably test it somehow, but I'm not.
Yeah, they gotta cut your brain open when they see
if you
have.
No, they probably just like put me on an fMRI machine and or something, look to see where things are firing.
Like, where does that start? Aside from the cause, genetic versus,
because you can see it light up in brain scans. You can see neurotransmitter responses.
Which one's
going? Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
it's really, really fascinating, and it's something that I don't know enough about. It's so complicated to me. I know like the basics, and I've just delivered that to you. But the level that we know about like what areas of our brain that are reacting to certain stimuli, it gets so in the weeds. Like people, we know a lot. I don't personally, but someone out there does.
Well, maybe we need to come back to the Dunning-Kruger effect on another podcast. Maybe. Isn't this the Dunning-Kruger effect?
I don't even know what that is.
I'll edit this out if I'm wrong. The Dunning-Kruger, you are like, I don't know much about this thing. Whereas I'm like, wow, she knows a lot about this thing. And it's the Dunning-Kruger effect, I think, is the name for the fallacy where the less you know about a thing, the more you think you know about it.
Mm.
Where like, I might go on a internet message board and like wielding all my neuroscience knowledge going, oh my God, look, oh, how stupid are you? You don't know about this because I don't know what I don't know.
Well,
whereas because you're a trained psychologist, you realize, oh man, a neuroscientist.
There's so much, like,
with
me, know.
Like compared to most of the listeners, like, I know a lot about music history, but if you ask me, I'm like, man, I'm not a musicologist. I don't know anything about that stuff. The more trained you are in a field, the more you realize how little you know in that field or in related fields. It's like, you're not, like, a neuroscientist.
I'm not a neurologist. Yeah. I'm, if at best, a developmental psychologist.
And that's a great flaw of you that we love.
But I also think that that's, like, kind of walking alongside imposter syndrome.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Right? This idea that, like, it's funny when I explain things to you and you're like, your face is like in awe. I'm like, oh, I might, maybe, do I know what I'm talking about? Like, is it true? Am I smart about science stuff? Maybe. I think I'm just kind of not making it up as I go. That's not the right word. But I think a good teacher has a healthy amount of imposter syndrome.
Oh, totally. And sometimes an unhealthy amount.
It makes us better.
I have a brother. I have an older brother. And I'm really sure he doesn't listen to this. And I think he knows that I know that. And that's going to make him forever not listen to it. So I'm going to just talk about him. He's a scientist.
Older sister's a scientist.
Oh, wow. Older siblings are weird.
Wait,
does that mean 100% of people's older siblings are scientists?
Right? I think it must be.
I think my brother does not have imposter syndrome, because my brother is trained in a very specific type of science, and he practices that, I'm sure, at a very high level. But if you ask my brother, like, a random science question, he will know the answer. But I don't think... I think he knows the answer, kinda. Mm. But he doesn't have the... Oh my God, well, I don't really know about geology. I better not answer this. No, he'll just answer. And then I'm like, oh, thanks, brother. And then I realize,
did he make
half of that up? Yeah. Like, does he really know? Because he didn't study that in college. He didn't study that as a PhD student. So it's funny. Like, I think musicians have a healthy amount of ego mixed with self-doubt.
I don't have a big ego.
Whatever.
And I notice in teaching, it's actually really nice to say to students, like, hey, I don't know the answer, but I'm going to look at, I'm going to figure it out. And next class, I'll come to you with the answer to your question, but I'm not just going to bullshit something. And I feel like a lot of teachers do just bullshit it, like your big brother.
I think my big brother probably would, but he's probably right most of the time, so it's fine. But
well, maybe not. How would you know? You're not fact checking.
Endless. In my field, I have the endless challenge of, someone's always going to bring up something that I haven't heard.
Yeah.
They're like,
awesome.
Oh, is this like what happens in that one Deftones album? It's like, I haven't heard that Deftones album
imagine,
or whatever.
Imagine, like, thank goodness, right? Like, wouldn't life be awful if you knew everything already? Like, what's the point? I don't understand when people are like, oh, and then like people that think that they know everything. It's like, how boring is that? Like, it's so interesting to learn new things.
I mean, not to get way off topic. We haven't even talked about Mariah Carey that much, but like, when I got to grad school, there was so much of that. My fraud complex, I didn't know anything yet, obviously. All I'd done is undergrad. Spoiler, you don't learn that much in undergrad, even if you're a music major.
No, you learn so much. Please go
You
to
learn
college.
About learning. You learn about how to learn.
Yes,
you learn how
you
to
learn. About,
so,
it's insightful.
But people were like all the time, oh, well, this is like in the Brahms concerto or whatever. And I would just be like looking around the room, sure, everybody knew everything everybody's referring to. Mm. And it's only like later that I realized, no, like half those people didn't and were just kind of going, oh yeah, just like me, right? And we all know a lot of stuff, but the overlap of what we all know is not perfect, right? So even if we all have, like, I bring to the table a bunch of music that none of them know and vice versa. And as a teacher of college students, I try to remember what that's like, because my professors, when I was a grad student, there's like this healthy mix where they were making references to things that on the one hand could be taken as a sign of respect that they trusted me enough to know that, but also was like a weird aggro move telling me, you better know this if you don't know it.
Right.
And that's like a weird, like, I have to be careful when I'm bringing up the canon. Like, if I'm bringing up some piece that I assume, whether it's classical music or pop song, like, am I bringing them in by assuming they all know it and saying, you're a part of the tribe of musicians? Of course, we all know Bohemian Rhapsody or Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
But you could be ostracizing
them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a weird balance that, like, the fraud complex, if you're a music major, is firing on all cylinders because you're only into hip hop and the guy next to you is only into hardcore punk. And you're like afraid that you're less cool because you don't know the hardcore punk band he's talking about. And then he's thinking the same thing. And like everybody's fear of me because my music is, as the professor, is simultaneously I'm the most lame of all of them, but yet I have the keys to the kingdom. I'm the cool one too. It's weird.
You know what else is firing in all cylinders is your dopaminergic reward pathway.
While I'm talking about this stuff?
A little psych humor. Yeah. Just trying to bring it back. But your dopaminergic reward pathway is like a dopamine is a really awesome neurotransmitter that makes us feel rewarded. Like every time you learn new knowledge and you feel good about yourself for like raising your hand and getting the right answer and your teacher says, yes, Mark, you're smart. You're like, yes, yeah. You get that zip. Like, I am smart. I am doing it. That's like your dopamine.
So even this
off.
Stuff is hormones and neurotransmitters,
yeah,
right? Everything is. And
literally everything.
This song is really just one dimension, but it's interestingly two reflections of that, extremes, I think. And we can come back to that.
Do you like to laugh, geek out on music, and learn all about that band or artist who had that one song back in the day, but then seemed to fall off the face of the earth? If so, you need to subscribe to One Hit Thunder. Together with an array of interesting and hilarious guests, we do a weekly dive into one-hit wonders like Eiffel 65's Blue, Krayshawn's Gucci Gucci, EMF's Unbelievable, Delamitri's Roll to Me, Los Del Rio's Macarena, Musical Youth's Pass the Dutchie, and even Patrick Swayze's She's Like the Wind. So are you subscribed to One Hit Thunder or what? As Desiree would say, you gotta be. And as K7 would encourage, you gotta come, baby, come and join in on the fun of the One Hit Thunder podcast.
Should we talk about Mariah more?
I'd love to talk about the song specifically.
I mean, where are you at with that? Let me, okay. Emotions.
I have a great episodic memory of this song.
Episodic memory. Shout out to episode one of season two.
Do you remember
Taylor
what,
Swift.
What an episodic memory is?
An episodic memory is when you watch an episode on Netflix and you remember it, but you experienced something and so you remember it, as opposed to a semantic memory, which is a fact.
Nice one.
I got it.
You did. And it's great. I love your Netflix analogy because that's how you remember. It's like an episode of your life. So back when I was growing up, we used to have to make mixtapes, like playlists, as the kids would call them nowadays. But we would have to record songs from the radio with like a cassette tape.
Sure.
Like you'd press play and record at the same time.
And so you've either got the last 3 seconds of the previous song or more likely you're missing the first
because
3 seconds.
Because like when
it
comes on the radio, you record it.
That's right.
And I put the song on a mixtape and I remember very specifically like waiting, trying to like catch it. So
this song, again, everybody, Emotions.
I love that reference to higher than the heavens above. Like
totally.
Word painting.
We could, right, because she says deeper than I've ever dreamed of, I think, and then higher than the heavens. And the deeper line is really low.
Yeah.
Higher than line is really high. And that's an example of something that goes back to the Renaissance or even earlier. Right.
Did she write this song? Did she write it? Lyrics
by
Mariah
Carey?
Yeah, so this
song written by, I don't know the lyrics versus music spread, but it's written by her. Plus the guys from CNC Music Factory.
Nice.
David Cole and Robert Seville's. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but you know, Gonna Make You Sweat, Everybody Dance Now,
also
guys.
Also on the mixtape.
Also on the, yeah, I mean, so it's the same thing. So were you a Mariah fan?
Yeah, I was.
I mean, this song was everywhere.
Yeah.
Number one hit, obviously. This, I don't think, is one of her biggest number ones, though. Like,
it has to be.
One Sweet Day with Boys to Men.
That was so good. You know we're Boys to Men fans here.
Yeah, they'll come up again,
I bet you a lot
of
her Christmas stuff is higher.
Yeah, this wasn't really, like, I never had a Mariah Carey album, but it felt like you heard her music so much that you know so many songs. But this one's, by the way, 1991.
Mm-hmm.
That the album it's on, Emotions, she collaborated with a lot of people on it. So like including Carole King, as well as CNC
Rainbow.
Music Factory guys. Did you see that there was an out-of-court settlement about this song?
No, tell me everything. Right. I love
the guys from Earth, Wind and Fire.
Oh.
Maurice White and Al Davis, two of the members, didn't sue, but settled out of court about this being an adaptation of their song, Best of My Love, which...
Play the clip.
Not Earth, Wind, and Fire song, Best of My Love, Weird Synergy, performed by The Emotions.
Okay. Oh,
and it's really just the backing instrumentation sounds similar. Shall I play Emotions again?
Yeah. You know, a year ago, I would have said, yeah, that's a total ripoff. But now I've learned so much in this podcasting process. Like, where does it end?
It's different enough. Kind of different enough.
It's like, it's fine. And you settle out of court, it just screams like, leave me alone.
It probably wouldn't have worked in court.
No,
so let's settle out of court.
There's no way, because like music is music. Like you can do whatever you want with it. Like there's only so many combinations.
Listeners and Nicole, I think we're going to talk about plagiarism later in this season.
You've been saying that for years.
And this is year two, and it will happen probably.
Okay.
Because I want to unpack this more, because the courts get it wrong sometimes. And this is a vibiness that's very similar. And there's certain figures of the groove and the bass line, but
I don't think
not exactly
suing
the same.
On vibes is a thing. Is it?
Talk to Pharrell and Robin Thicke about that. We'll come back to that with Marvin Gaye
Robin
later.
Robin Thicke.
I'll probably,
dude, that's problem.
Another
that's
problematic.
Talk about problem.
Yeah, hey, I'm not rallying to his defense, but the courts maybe got it wrong there. So, anyways,
the video is awful.
Here's the thing that people really, the video. Yeah, oh my god,
it's like, what are we doing?
So this, I would say, this is the most or one of the most memorable parts of the song, and it's not just the hook; it's this.
It's crazy.
Wait. Okay. It's
like,
crazy.
Can she do it live? Like, is she doing it live? Or is she using a Larry track, which is for sure something I just made up?
That no, you talked about that already before, and it was something I'd never heard.
Yeah,
a layering to save your voice.
Yeah.
So I actually watched some live videos of her.
Yeah.
And there's a whole thing about her on New Year's Eve one day that there's like a controversy and all that. But I don't even want to get into
that.
They were feuding with Dick Clark's people because it's their fault.
Like,
no, it's her fault, etc. Not weighing in on that at all.
Yeah.
But she does the high note live always.
Okay.
Spectacularly. But the she often doesn't do. And I wonder if that's what's so hard.
The breath control.
It's the getting to the note. She can hit the note live consistently, but there might be a 5% chance that something goes wrong if she does the full run. That in all the live videos I saw, and people, listeners write in, we'll ask our guest next week maybe, does she ever do the full thing? It's just one of those things, like you make choices in the studio, and then when it comes time to learn, like with me even, and I'm no Mariah Carey to say the least, there are choices I'm making about my guitar part or my vocal line while I'm doing the same them at the same time, that what I did in the studio is not going to exactly happen. I have to make accommodations because I still have to sing 30 more minutes
of
a set.
Right, there's so many variables in live performance. Like, you just want to give the people what they want, and they want that high note.
So I would just say, yeah, she can do it live, but doesn't do it the same live. She does the high note. But
which I think must be harder in some capacity because you're not like scaffolding up to it. You're just like hearing the note and hitting it. And it wasn't having perfect pitch, but it was like you used another word that I forget.
I don't know.
That you, like, you hear it in your head.
Audiation. Yeah,
like maybe
good.
Just,
audiation.
I knew it was there somewhere.
She's hearing it. I think it's a mechanical thing. I think so. This is what we're getting into today. So this is what's called her whistle register. I actually don't want to talk about different registers of voice as much because I want to come back to that. Listeners inspired another episode that I want to come back to a little later in the season. But
is it about yodeling?
Okay, so yodeling. What yodeling is the switch between registers rapidly in a way kind of Mariah-like where I can't yodel, but basically you're going your sort of middle voice, your chest voice up to your falsetto. Flipping between them really fast. Listeners, I can't do it. Should I go back? Should I... correct it to make it sound beautiful, and then they're like, why is she making fun of him? It sounds beautiful.
I making fun of you?
No,
I think
it
was possibly
funny. I was ready for it.
A sarcastic tone.
So she that what I've learned, I've done a lot of vocal writing, like whether it's pop songs or when I write, so to speak, classical music, I write a lot of choir, write a lot of art songs. there's a way you do high notes, and there's an approach. Like, just having someone go higher, 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 higher is brutal on the voice. It kills it. There's a way that you shape the melody, and is doable, but there's something about the acrobatics that if you're setting up for that high note, it just may be asking too much. That I don't know the intricacies of her voice in the whistle tone to know, but All right. So interestingly enough, I looked up the official Hal Leonard publisher sheet music.
You love Hal Leonard.
Do I love Hal? Me and Hal go way back.
Yeah.
No, I do look up the sheet music sometimes to see whether they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And they give the range as this of 5 octaves and 5 half steps, which is massive. And they say a low B2. A low B2 is so low that it's very thoroughly like a bass note. Like I can sing it fine, but It's pretty low even in my range. And then a high G7. And honestly, I don't hear the low B2 when I listen to the song. I hear a low E3, which I think it's like she does like deeper than the dream of. And there's a kind of little.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it kind of goes back to our Tim Storms Guinness book. Like, is she singing that note or is she kind of just going, oh, right? The high G is another little flick. The ba-da-da-da-ba-da-da-da. She's clearly hitting an E, and does she just sort of tap? So shrug, whatever.
I'm giving her the credit.
It's massive. Yeah. It's a massive range.
It's a massive
and
range.
What I want to talk about really is flipping between it rapidly as a way of conveying the extreme emotions that she's talking about.
I love that.
Right? So it's not just the high range. It's that there's a few moments where she sort of breaks continuity that any mere mortal would just sing the next note and the melody. But what she does is sings that next note way higher or way lower than any of us would be able to comfortably do. And this is sort of a songwriting trick called octave displacement, But also sort of a performance trick. I could just write this in a song, but often this is something that might be brought to the song by a performer. Because they can. Because most of us can't switch
like
that quickly. Let's listen again to the chorus and think about the continuity of the vocal line within that range. Like, how close are the notes to one another? So in each little fragment of the tune, the notes are kind of close together. There's some jumps, but between phrases, she's an extremely different, like, got me feeling emotions is kind of in her high, like trumpety, like belty register. And then deeper than is super low. And then higher than the heavens is still kind of in that higher.
Yeah.
She's setting up the expectation of a certain amount of disjointedness in this melody. Right.
And it's so like literal with her. Like the lyrics and her vocal expression are so like literally connected to each other. It's
well,
really
that's that
cool.
We call it word painting or text
love
painting.
It. Love it.
Deeper than I've ever dreamed of is low. Higher than the heavens above. Of course, I got friends in low places. Right. That's other famous 90s star.
You sound just like him when he sings.
Do I? Yeah. Okay.
You're so versatile.
I'm from San Diego, dude. There was so much country music when I was a kid.
I bet.
So not only is the melody disjointed, but it has a lot of leaps. This is characteristic of music for a diva, or like Freddie Mercury or Bobby McFerrin. These amazing vocalists tend to have the capacity to dream up melodies that have so many more leaps. Whereas we've talked about in other episodes that most melodies are stepwise, meaning the notes are only one note apart, because most humans can sing that stuff, whereas most humans cannot sing like this. And so the songwriting becomes informed by the capabilities of your performer, right?
Cool.
And then you decide you're going to write a song about emotions and you go, well, let's set that to 11 out of 10, right? So listen here to the verse. We have, again, starting off low and then jumping to a high place.
Yeah, and this idea of like being intoxicated by love, like that is a very real feeling. And a lot of people, you know, this vasopressin oxytocin response is actually really similar to a cortisol response. like really similar to like, think of like when you fall in love for the first time, like you're getting a rapid heart rate, probably elevated blood pressure, probably like getting like cold sweats, feeling this nervous feeling, like those are the same physiological feelings of anxiety, but you're just mapping them to a love expression rather than like a fear expression. But your body's doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. These drugs that function in our body, how they like invoke feelings, but you do need context for the feeling, because a blank slate would feel love and anxiety in the same way and the feelings in their body. It's just, you need your brain to connect the dots to tell you like what,
which where it's one coming it from. Is.
Yeah. It's That's really so cool. Weird. It's super cool.
Whoa. So it's like relative. Emotions are relative. Or no, they're constant, but are given meaning by the context.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is so weird. It's like hard to wrap my brain around that. But yet I must.
Yeah, for some reason you must. It's actually better if you don't think about it.
Yeah.
And just let it cook.
Well, it's like you can't.
Because then what do you trust?
I don't think psychologists really, by and large, probably have more control over their emotions. Like, does learning about this affect, like, it affects my perception of music to understand music, but does, you're still
feeling
servant
it.
To the chemicals,
yeah,
and the context.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's like inoculation, like this attitudinal inoculation, like you know what's causing it. Like, I'm someone that I'm an anxious human, like I have panic attacks, like I do. And I know that it's just because my nervous system is dysregulated and my cortisol levels are high. Like, I know that that's what's causing it, but it still doesn't make it go away.
You can use it to talk you down, but it still happens,
like,
right?
I cognitively understand it, but like, I'm still, like, my heart's beating a mile a minute. Like, it doesn't, I can know that, like, oh, I'm just anxious because of my previous experience in this environment that's causing my anxiety to spike, but it doesn't help me talk myself down.
Yeah.
For some people, it probably does, but I'm just not there yet. Like, I just have to ride the wave, even though I know what's causing the tsunami. You're still in the wave, you know?
Yeah, it's still there. It's still a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It actually makes it harder because you know better. You're like, I know that I'm safe right now. I know that I'm safe going into the grocery store. So why am I feeling panicked? Like, I know nothing bad's going to happen at the movie theater or at the grocery store, but I'm still like panicked in those moments. It's tricky.
You don't
Anxiety
strike
is tricky.
Me as a very judgy person,
no,
but like, then there's a sense of like, if I know this shouldn't be happening, why am I letting this happen?
Yeah, it's a self. I don't judge other people, but I judge myself for sure. Of like, I should know better. It's that I'm sure you have that in your field too. Like, you should know better.
Totally.
Than to like,
be just flat when I'm singing, like,
right? But, like, you should know better. Like, you should be able to yodel, like, get it together.
Right.
Right? Well, not that I'm saying you should, but I think that we're more judgmental on ourselves, and I think psychologists are victim to that too, because we should know better.
Wild. But also, like, you're drawn to psychology for a reason too, right?
Yeah, because it's like I'm trying to solve the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. The unsolvable puzzle.
Yeah, it's really fascinating.
We don't get the benefit of like, I cracked the code. I now can explain every Aaron Dresner, Taylor Swift collaboration. That doesn't happen with the brain, right?
Well, because that's like the best part. Like I was saying before, like, wouldn't it be a drag if you knew everything? What's the point? Like, it's fun to always uncover and to know that even if I know, like, I can tell in someone, I can see depression on someone, I can see anxiety on a student in front of me. Like, I can see what they're physically doing with their body, their physiological presentation and the manifestation of that. But I don't know what's causing it. They probably don't even know what's causing it. But I can guess that it's something to do with their past. I can guess that it's maybe something tricky going on in their neurobiology that's causing this feeling, or their cortisol levels are off. Like, I know physiologically that's what's happening, but the root of that is so nuanced. And it's crazy that we're all made up of the same stuff. Like, biologically, we're, for the most part, all made up of the same stuff, but our reactions to things are so different. When I know love is love is love is an oxytocin vasopressin response, but how come I'll look at someone and love them and you'll look at someone and hate them? Just first glance, right? Like, what's causing that?
Case in point, your husband.
I look at him and
just
love him.
Just kidding. No, yeah. He's awesome. He's awesome.
He doesn't listen to this, so he'll never hear it.
He and my brother should hang out. Yeah. Well, also, by the way, the joke I made about Taylor Swift and Dresden, you can't crack the code. That's the thing is what I did. I'm referring to our first episode of this season is like, oh, I figured it out. What I did was uncover one little thing about a few things.
There's a formula.
That's beautiful.
But there's like a hidden variable, and that is like the nuance of the human experience.
You can never understand the mind. You can never really understand music either, because it's art or it's expression and all sorts of things.
You're a very good musician. I have like a mediocre singing voice. If you and I re-recorded the Folklore album, it would not, even if we like followed it perfectly, it wouldn't have that same magic.
Nicole's version of Folklore? Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
The Marx version. It would not. Yeah.
Even if like we got the mechanics right, it's not the same. Just like the mechanics of our neurotransmitters are similar for the most part. Everyone has nuance for sure. But the presentation is different because we all have this other layer to us called our subconscious, which is a different conversation.
Let me get to that. We got to get to our climax here.
All right. Okay. I'm ready.
So when we hear the pre-chorus section, we're going to start to hear even bigger jumps. Right. She covers a whole 10th of her range, which means an octave plus a few more notes. And she jumps up a 7th, which is 7 whole notes. We're building towards even being more sort of range disjointed. We're getting to basically the reason I chose this song here. Take a listen. What happens at the end of that? Can you hear it in your brain? Can you audiate what happens next? She has the payoff here. So she's saying, I love the way, what is it?
I like the way you're feeling inside.
Like the feeling inside, but she doesn't just go to the note. Mm-hmm. She goes to the note an entire octave higher than it's supposed to be. She goes into her whistle register. It's supposed to be a G going to a G, G4 to G5. She jumps all the way up to a G6, which is not only out of most people's range, but so far away from the note she started. Maybe inside is kind of a weird word to do that. But on the other hand, like this well of emotion is just about to burst.
Yeah.
Right?
Can you audiate that? Like, could you hear it before she sings it?
Yes.
Me too.
Can I create that note? No. That is
an
insane.
I can sing it in my head.
You could probably whistle it out. I don't think I could whistle it out, even if I tried. I don't have the note.
I think I could. I'm not going to try. We're just going to trust and not verify.
I say I don't think I could. I think I've got a solid octave lower than that. It's the highest note I can sing.
I think you could pull it off.
No, never. So she's in the top of the piano land there. So
you need a castrato.
We've actually heard, so like what you hear, a castrato, huh? We're going to talk Italian mutilations.
Yeah.
Do we know about the castrati, everybody? Nicole, explain to everybody what the castrati are.
You can castrate someone with a lower voice, and allegedly it makes them have a higher voice, like a lady.
Well, as they're a boy, so as you take a boy.
Yeah, a biological male.
This is in the Renaissance up until the last castrati were made. In the 1800s, there's actually recordings of some from the early 1900s or some maybe late 1800s, early recordings where this guy was 90 years old or whatever. But still, the Italian opera and even the church was doing this.
The church?
The Catholic Church.
Weird. Off-brand for them.
You take a really good singer and you castrate him so he stays... really never loses
so
his voice. And it's a way, this part of this is all wrapped up in patriarchy, misogyny, like we want to feature men in performance. And in a church context, in certain eras, you could only have male singers because women wouldn't have been allowed to sing in certain contexts. But you get the like power and size of a man, and so the volume, but the range of like a operatic soprano. And so you would get these crazy high notes that if you listen to these recordings, and maybe I'll dig it in and pipe it in, and you can hear it when you listen to the episode one day. Hi, everybody. Mark here. This is actually a recording of Alessandro Moreschi, who is an Italian singer who was the only castrato to be captured on a solo recording. There are some recordings of some that were singing as a part of ensembles, but you can't really hear them very clearly. This was made in 1902, so he was actually only in his 40s at this point. But allegedly past his prime at that point, he died in 1922. This is an excerpt of him performing Eugenio Terziani's Ostias et Preces.
Mm-hmm.
that.
It's kind of haunting, and maybe that's because it's an old recording and this guy was already really old when he recorded it. But it's an ethereal sound and a very, very, very heinous practice, because apparently, like, just like anything, the odds of you becoming world famous
super slim
are super low. And so they would, like, the boys choir director or whatever in some town in Italy in the 1700s would be castrating these boys, and like one in 50 would become an opera superstar, and the other ones would just live the rest of their lives compromised for the sake of somebody else's profit. Yeah.
Like, add it to the list.
Add it to the list of wild, heinous crap people do.
Yeah.
So, doesn't necessarily have to do... Mariah Carey, luckily, was just born...
She was born castrated.
She does not have the
testicles.
Hormones that would cause a man's voice. That's true. And so, no, but she also has crazy range.
You're wrong, Mark. She does have the hormones.
Ooh, in different balance.
In different balance.
Thank you. She does have...
The biological markers of testicles, they are just her ovaries.
Ovaries, yes. Because we are all the same mushy stuff.
Just
remixed.
What did I say? Meat puppets.
Meat puppets, yeah. Do you like the meat puppets?
I like the term meat puppet when referencing humans, but I don't know the band.
You know the Nirvana covers and all that.
Yes.
Okay, so we've actually heard a moment almost the same as this. So we have this jump. Way back in, like, I don't know, episode 5, we heard True by Spandau Ballet.
Oh, that's a good one.
And it's actually the same chord, or very close to the same chord, and he hits the same note, except he's doing it with a single octave leap that we sort of would expect from a really nice, awesome singer. Can you audiate the next?
Does it jump up two octaves?
No, he does that the way he's supposed to do that. She does the same thing, except pops an entire higher octave. So this is, again, called octave displacement. And what you're doing is taking an expected note, shifting it by an octave higher or an octave lower for various musical effects. Mm. In this case, I would say heightened emotion is the musical effect. It's a hyperextension of the jumpiness and the sort of disjointedness that the song has already had.
And that's the name of the song.
Emotions.
Emotion.
I do have some other examples of artists doing this. Nobody doing it quite like her. So, podcast alumnus, Tears for Fears. This one's simple. This is not crazy range. This is a song called Change from their 1983 album. They just change which octave a melody note happens in. Mm-hmm. It's not showing off. It's just repeating a melody, and the next time you repeat it, changing the octave. Take a listen. It's all too late. I did not have the time. I did not have the nerve to ask you how you feel. Is this what you deserve? So that those notes are the same.
Huh.
Instead of just repeating it, you pop it up the second time.
It doesn't seem like as beneficial in that Tears for Fears song as it does in the Mariah Carey song for me. Like, it doesn't seem like it has that a big payoff to do it. It just seems like an acrobatic or a trick.
It's not spectacular in the same way. Yeah. That's more of just a songwriting, this melody note will be the same thing reflected up.
Mm.
She is doing it as a climax.
It's so hard to even compare anyone to Mariah Carey. Like,
correct.
No matter what, it's going to be like, oh, I guess Tears for Fears did it too. Like, no one does it like her.
Yeah, I mean, apologies to anybody else I'm playing in this episode.
You're never going to be as good as Mariah Carey.
And that's okay. You be you. We're all still just meat puppets, right? Here's another example. So this is Haim, which is a band that has already been mentioned in this podcast.
We talk about it a lot, but we haven't focused on
them. I think we're going to focus on Haim later.
Too. We're both fans.
This is a song called The Steps from 2020.
So good.
This time you would expect the melody should jump up a fourth. She adds a whole octave to it, jumping up a whole 11th on this one high note. Listen. Every day I wake up and I make money for myself, and though we share that, you know that I don't need your help. Do you understand? right? Just that understand, mm-hmm. right? Pops up the extra octave, still feels melodic. It doesn't feel show-offy,
sure.
But the songwriting is giving a little extra spice, I think.
Their songwriting's great. I'm a fan. I think that their tone is so good. I think that they're just great, like, girl power stuff there.
Totally. We'll come back to them,
they're
sure.
They're so good. That whole album's great that's off of. But...
Yeah, Women in Music, Part 3.
It's great, yeah.
So... It's been too long since we talked about Taylor Swift.
I know.
And you wouldn't let me promise never to. Here's All You Had to Do Was Stay from 1989. And we get her popping up an octave at the end of the phrase. All you had to do was stay. 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 And the last time when she just sings, all you had to do was stay, yeah. We hear the real note. But every other time, it's all you had to do was stay. You got it? I can't do it.
I can't. I'm not going to. But in this example of octave displacement, we're seeing that it does really mirror like a desperation in the lyrics.
Yeah.
It feels like a reach because that's what the lyrics want us to do. Yeah, like it's like kind of begging him or her, them to stay.
Right.
So I think for me, it's always if there's an application that like references back to the context of the song, like I'm really into it. And if it feels just like a show off trick, I'm not that into it.
But you're not. Oh, you are into it in emotions because.
Oh, yeah, because it does like kind of mirror this like rise and fall of human emotions. And in this Taylor Swift example, it mirrors like it talks about like the it feels desperate. It feels like you're reaching for someone trying to pull them back is how I interpret it.
Yeah,
but totally. I overinterpret.
All right. I got one more other example. I'm playing this one because this is another podcast alumnus going back to the first episode we recorded, but it's not the first episode we released. Third Eye Blind, Semi-Charmed Life.
Yeah.
The part everybody remembers. I want something else. I'm not listening when you say goodbye. The sort of real melody there would be goodbye, but he goes goodbye. Or whatever, yeah. I can barely do it, but he jumps a whole tenth instead of a third.
I like it there too. I mean,
octave
I think
displacement,
just because it's a surprise in that song, like you don't expect it to happen, and it does seem like you just showing off some vocal chops there.
Yeah,
but
it's good.
I don't know, it's good. It like fits for me in a way that like maybe the Tears for Fears didn't so much.
All right, maybe you're just kind of hating on Tears for Fears. I don't know.
No, just so interesting given all my talk about like emotions, you know, Tears for Fears.
Well, yeah, there was a whole, we went on a whole thing about the psychology connections.
Yeah, we
totally
talked about psychology.
The big chair.
The big chair.
We talked about psychologists in that episode.
That's what it was.
Hey, everybody. Go back. Listen to the episode on Everybody Wants to Rule the World.
Hey, everybody.
That's a good episode.
Mark here,
yeah.
I love that.
Mark here from the future. Yeah. Mark here editing. Okay, so a couple more examples of this popping up of the song.
Eric.
You guys get the point. I've hit it pretty hard. But here's the bridge section. We start with some wide leap, 7/6. But otherwise, it's pretty just straightforward melody writing. But then, of course, she explodes into the super high notes. You know the way to make me lose control. When you're looking into my eyes, you make me feel so.
It's really just impressive. Like the richness of her vocal tone, like in a lower range, is like so velvety and lovely that she can still like even pull that off when she reaches the higher register.
Like she shouldn't be able to have so many good parts of her voice.
It shouldn't sound so good.
One of them should be bad at least, right?
Like it's not even, she seems subhuman, like, or ultra human
super,
or something.
Super human.
Am I blowing too much steam to Mariah Carey right now? Am I like inflating her too much? I'm just like such a big fan.
I think she's getting what
her
she's due.
Fine,
I think she's
fine.
She doesn't need us, but I think she's getting what she's due. Like,
right? She's so impressive.
I should note that this isn't octave displacement. She's just building higher and higher, right? It's kind of the payoff. But like, I do think it's a little unfair that you're giving so much awesome praise, but then you're not really paying a lot of respect to Tim Storms here.
Here we go. It's like weird.
Come on, that's pretty cool too.
It's cool if you're like a bullfrog.
Well, he's part bullfrog. And it's cool. I mean, he's got a neat sounding voice.
It's a neat sounding voice. I take it all back.
So like wrapping up this song, at the outro, we actually hear the contrast between the ranges simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Because she's doing the whistle thing while she's doing the tune. Maybe there's some backup vocalists too, but I think it just might be the Mariahs.
Yeah.
And we hear it all, the sort of contrast between the registers simultaneously. We're talking about extreme emotions. We're talking about all the chemicals that fire to cause those emotions.
Uh-huh.
I don't know enough to really speak with any authority, obviously, about this. But we're talking about extreme changes rapidly in those emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2001, she got a diagnosis for bipolar type 2.
Oh.
Bipolar 2 disorder, which
sure.
I don't really understand the differences. But like,
okay.
Is it off base for me to put this out there? As like extreme changes in emotion might be a part of Mariah's world, her like life experience.
Yes.
Right.
Holding that diagnosis 1,000,000%. So we all have like, think of your emotions on like a pendulum, right? That we're all swinging between like happy, we'll say like happy and sad, right? Mm-hmm. High and low. And that like, we all have like a normal, like a little, like a, I don't know what normal would be statistically, but like we all have like a range of like swinging high and then swinging low. Someone with bipolar, their highs are really, really high. Like it's, if your pendulum swing just like a little bit, Mariah or anyone with this diagnosis, you could say their pendulum swing like all the way to the top and then all the way to the other side, like back and forth.
And bipolar two has to do with certain swings aren't as far, right? There's only certain parts.
Bipolar one is more severe than bipolar two.
Okay.
In that they have manic episodes, which is like hypervigilant, hyper focused on things, like not sleeping for days, like kind of wild eyed. Like people's like pupils actually change during manic episodes. They're like spun, right?
Sure.
And may include depressive episodes as well. Bipolar 2 includes that mania and depressive episodes, but they're usually less severe.
Okay.
So we used to call this manic depression before they recoded it to bipolar. So in bipolar 1, the mania and the depressive episodes are so severe that they may last a really long time or require like you to be hospitalized as well.
Okay.
And bipolar 2 is more easily managed without hospitalization. Okay. You need to take medicine for it to regulate for sure. Like a lot, you know, someone that says that they have bipolar is like Kanye, right? You see Kanye having really high highs where he kind of goes off the rails sometimes, which is not a clinical term. And a lot of times with people with bipolar, you'll see them at their high highs. Like you'll see when they're going a mile a minute, they're being like super creative. They're like the life of the party, right?
Sure.
Really up. But you don't often see them at their lower moments because they hide because they're depressed, right? The serotonin's not connecting in those moments. There's no happy juice flowing around their brain. So it's really important to regulate with meds if you have this diagnosis. I never knew that about Mariah Carey. It makes sense if you're thinking of this song.
Maybe this wasn't to the extent that this had fully developed when in 1991. I don't know, but there might have been kind of sensation of extremeness emotionally. And with that, I don't want to trivialize it by saying, oh, she put it in the song. But I noticed that when I was just looking into her, and I thought it was worth dropping considering the theme I was trying to tackle here.
Yeah, I think that it definitely has relevance, absolutely. And bipolar 2, and bipolar 1 is very, very common and very treatable. Like it's not, I think it's more stigmatized in the media than it needs to be. Like plenty of people, you know, have like moments of mania and depression that are clinical. Plenty of people have it that are subclinical, and like that's fine too. So, so we talk about like falling and like rapid shifts, right?
Yeah.
And I started thinking about like skydiving a lot.
Oh boy.
And bungee jumping a lot.
Yeah.
Have you ever skydove?
I have not. I think there was a time in my life when I would have, and that time has passed.
Right.
I think I am not interested anymore. Like I think if I was in my 20s, and I've never been like, I wasn't the kid, you know, going belly first on a skateboard down the steep hill across the street. Like that was the neighbor kid doing that.
Mm.
But I think that now I'm just too, oh man, it would really suck if I died. It would suck for my family if I died. It would suck for me if I died.
Way to go, your frontal lobe is developed. Yeah, like, you're not as risk-centered as you might have been.
I think it seems fun, but I think it would also be so terrifying that I just probably wouldn't. I won't. Would I? Yes. Will I? No.
Yeah. There is no amount of money that you could pay me to do that. Literally
not even like $20.
Not even $20.
So that actually, I actually think you could totally overcome, because I think I grew up kind of wanting to do it. Like, oh, that sounds fun. You could pay me an amount of money that would make me do it.
What would it be? Name your price.
Oh, shoot.
I've got it. I've got the money.
It's funny because I almost would just do it. Like, I'm not that far away. I won't do it, but I'm almost, like, how much would it, I want to say $1 million, but actually.
I'd say 5 million.
Way less, because I don't think I would take that much. The right amount of peer pressure or whatever would get me to do it already.
Really?
Maybe.
Dude, you got to hold like my for that
wife,
bag.
If my wife was desperately wanted to do
There's
it
no
and
way.
All of our friends.
Yeah.
Maybe it would resurrect the 20-year-old idiot in me. But I don't know. A few thousand. Like, it has to. Like, I don't know.
A few thousand.
I don't know. Maybe I want to do it, but I never will. That's what I'm saying. I would, but I won't.
There's too much at stake.
What about money? And so that's the thing. Money could. Well, like, hey, if $10 million, like, it's fine if I die. You know, my kids are fine, right? Maybe that's what it is. What amount of money replaces my income over the rest of their life? Like, I don't know.
There's no replacement, Mark.
Yeah, there's no replacement.
Money isn't everything, bro.
Who would host this podcast, right? If I died in a freak, but yet
a freak
predictable
skydiving
accident?
Very predictable. Nevermind the Music is hosted by Nicole Batcher and hosted and produced by Mark Poppany. You can email us at nevermusicpod@gmail.com and give us a follow on social media. Nevermind the Music is also part of the Lorehounds Network. Please join the conversation on their Discord server. Thanks for listening.